Welcome to Beneath the Surface, a podcast brought to you by the BC Mining Law Reform Network, or BCMLR. Since our inception in 2019, BCMLR has been advocating for the reform of the Mineral Tenure Act. In fact, reforming this piece of legislation was a crucial reason for BCMLR's creation. In this episode, we look at a recent court case that's centered on the Mineral Tenure Act. My name is Umair Mohammed, and my guest today is Gavin Smith, a staff lawyer with West Coast Environmental Law. Our listeners will likely know of West Coast Environmental Law, an organization that has been working to protect the environment and advance Indigenous rights for the last 50 years. That's 10 times longer than BCMLR has existed. So kudos to them. Their work has, of course, involved pushing for mineral tenure reform, and their approach and advocacy in this area have been instrumental in shaping BCMLR's mission and strategies. Gavin's work with West Coast Environmental Law has included fighting against the Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipelines and Tankers proposal, the passage and implementation of BC's new Environmental Assessment Act, and supporting Indigenous nations to revitalize their own laws. Gavin and I will be chatting about Kitkatla versus British Columbia, a court case that was heard and decided on by the BC Supreme Court last year. Gavin serves on the Kitkatla First Nations legal team, so he's obviously a great person to be talking with about this. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Gavin. Before we get into the heart of our discussion, do you maybe just want to take a few minutes to tell us a little bit about West Coast Environmental Law and, you know, just about, a bit about its work and its history?
Sure. So West Coast Environmental Law has been around since 1974 and is an environmental law charity that is focused really on changing the legal landscape. And so that has involved a lot of work over the years on provincial and federal law reform. We also provide summary legal advice on environmental issues to communities and individuals in British Columbia. And a large part of our work has also been supporting Indigenous nations in upholding their own laws related to land, air, and water in their territory. Since 2016, that has taken the shape of what's called the RELAW program, or Revitalizing Indigenous Law for Land, Air, and Water. And I've been a staff lawyer at West Coast for about, 12 years, 11 years now, something like that.
And one of the things you guys work on is tenure reform in BC. What does that term mean, and why is it important?
Yeah, so when we talk about tenure reform, specifically in this case, we're talking about mineral tenure reform. But tenures are the legal tool by which interests in resources are granted from the Crown under Crown law to usually companies to carry out resource extraction. And so the particular focus of recent work has been in mineral tenure reform, which is governed in British Columbia under the Mineral Tenure Act. And that it's basically the law through which mineral explorationists, mineral exploration interests, acquire the rights to minerals as well as the rights to conduct certain exploration activities that form the foundation for potential future mining activities and the development of mines on that tenure.
And the other big area for tenure reform would be logging?
Exactly, yes. So, I mean, there's also oil and gas tenures. It's basically any purported Crown ownership of resources that is granted to third parties.
That's good for background. And then, so let's talk about the court case, Kitkatla versus British Columbia. So what prompted the Kitkatla Nation to bring forward their legal challenge against BC's mineral claim system?
Yeah, so to start that question, or to answer that question, I'll start by going way back. So there's an immediate context for why Kitkatla brought the case, which I'll get to. But the long story is really the Mineral Tenure Act and its predecessors have been one of the foremost tools of colonization in the province of BC. And so even before British Columbia was a province, when it was still a colony, it enacted what was called the Goldfields Act of 1859. It was focused particularly on gold, as you might imagine at the time. It was the gold rush in BC. And BC was concerned about American miners coming up, particularly along the Fraser and the sort of threats to British sovereignty that were perceived from those activities. And so they used regulation of mining and gold mining in particular as a primary tool to assert the authority of the British Crown over what is now known as British Columbia. And so the Goldfields Act of 1859 introduced many of the terms and concepts that are still present in the Mineral Tenure Act today. For example, a free miner's certificate, which is what are called free miners still get in BC. It's the what gives you the right to call yourself a free miner, and that's what allows you to stake mineral claims. And importantly, the Goldfields Act, it used the term wastelands of the crown, was the actual legal term that was used in there. And so it was really based on the idea that these are lands belonging to no one, to which the crown is claiming its own rights and distributing those rights to third parties, including in at that time, American gold miners, who then had to sort of submit to crown regulation. And it was a way of, you know, asserting British authority over the territories. And the reason that I go all the way back there is that it's really important context for everything that has happened since in relation to mineral tenures, which are granted on an automatic basis. Now it happens online, but it used to be that you would actually literally go and put stakes in the ground, hence the term staking a claim, and you would then go and you would record that claim. So there was no decision-making per se in that act. You just went and put some stakes in the ground, and then you got that recorded by the crown, and it was yours. And the purpose was really to encourage mineral exploration, but it also had a second purpose and an effect of dispossessing Indigenous peoples of their rights in their own territory. So, you know, once those claims were staked, the rights to minerals in that area belong to the claim holders, but also the rights to conduct mineral exploration activities. And so that's evolved over time, but the basic structure of that regime still exists under the Mineral Tenure Act. It is now, it's now done online. So rather than putting stakes in the ground, they're obtaining interests on a map. But the actual underlying effect is the same, that those rights are acquired automatically without any role for Indigenous nations in their own territory. So that's sort of the bigger picture context, I would say.
You know, while researching for this discussion, I found a YouTube video called Acquire a BC Gold Claim Easy. That's the title.
And it is.
And then he goes through the steps of buying a cell. And yeah, it's very easy.
Yeah. And well, you know, it's interesting. So this is getting ahead of things a bit now, but one of the things when Gahatla launched the litigation that they did was that they put an affidavit, which is sort of written evidence in the case, that was show to the court, to demonstrate to the court how the process worked. A lawyer who had never engaged in mineral exploration before started from scratch and explained the steps that he took to become a free miner, to go online and to purchase a mineral claim in Gahatla's territory, which was actually free for him to do because he was a senior. So he didn't even have to pay any of the fees to get a free miner certificate. He had to then pay for the mineral claim. But it basically took him about 3 days of his time, and it was all done online, and he had no prior experience with mineral exploration at all. So it is really a very straightforward process. So anyways, with all of that said, in that context, for Gahatla specifically, the mineral claims that they challenged were all on Lac Nagajol or Banks Island, which is sort of with part of the heart of Gahatla territory. And there's a pretty awful story of what's called the Banks Island Yellow Giant Gold Mine, which resulted from mineral tenures that were acquired without Gahatla's knowledge or obviously consent, given that it didn't know about them. And then despite Gahatla's objections, mineral exploration and then mining activities were approved on Banks Island, resulting in the Yellow Giant Gold Mine, which was approved in 2014, started operations in 2015. It almost immediately started illegally discharging waste into an old mine shaft, basically, which then leaked out into the environment. Then failed to report that. And it was basically through a whistleblower that the province eventually found out about it. the mine, barely a year into operation, was issued a stop work order because of violations. The company then went bankrupt, and Gahatla has been left holding the bag of this contaminated site, effectively, that still has mine infrastructure on it that they never consented to and, in fact, actively opposed. And while they were dealing with the fallout from all of this, which was the stop work order and then the bankruptcy in 2016, just within a couple of years of that, they learned that a bunch of mineral tenures, again, had been registered on Banks Island, again, without even their knowledge or consent. They found out about it through someone happened to check online. And it was really sort of the last straw, where they were determined to make sure that the groundwork for this type of activity causing harm without their consent never happened again. And so they determined to launch a legal challenge to those specific mineral claims on Banks Island that were granted between 2018 and 2020.
And so the challenge was launched, the court heard the case, and reached a decision. So, I mean, we're skipping a few steps, but we may as well. So what was that decision?
Sure. So the court found in September 2023 that there is a duty to consult owed by the Crown to First Nations, including Gahatla, before granting mineral claims in their territory, and that the Crown was breaching that duty. It issued a declaration to that effect. It did suspend that declaration for 18 months, which means basically it's paused. So it exists but has no legal effect yet. It will come into effect in 18 months. And as a result of that suspension, the court didn't quash or set aside the specific mineral claims that Gahatla had challenged, nor did it issue an injunction against further automatic mineral claims in Gahatla's territories. And so Gahatla has launched a partial appeal of those aspects of the decision that left those tenures in place and that refused to stop the harm in the meantime, if you will, while all parties have accepted, or they've elected not to appeal, the actual declaration of the duty to consult. So it is now that declaration stands, that the BC government now must consult Indigenous nations before granting mineral claims.
Yeah, that it shouldn't be so easy. It shouldn't be a YouTube video showing you how easy it is, among other things. But to me, that seems quite momentous. Could you sort of elaborate on the importance of the ruling?
For sure. It is a major win. Like many legal victories, it is nuanced, and there are some pieces that were not victories, which we can perhaps talk about later as well. But it's really important to emphasize this has been decades and decades of advocacy and work by Indigenous nations, by environmental groups, to try and get the system changed, with, I would say, virtually no progress. There were some consultations or engagements, I should say, launched by BC in sort of 2017 to 2019 about, you know, considering Mineral Tenure Act reform that didn't go anywhere. This has been, you know, just a constant drumbeat from Indigenous nations for many, many years that this system is a total violation of their rights and needs to be changed. And successive provincial governments have done nothing about it. And so this declaration from the court is momentous in that it will require a new mineral tenure regime after many, many years of advocacy to bring about that change. And that is a significant win.
And I guess we'll see what the nature of that regime will be. But reading through some of the documents and the judge's decision, and of course the brief that you guys prepared as well, there was, you know, a fair bit of discussion about the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, as well as BC's Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act. Could you discuss how these frameworks influence the court's decision? And what this might mean for their application in future legal challenges? And maybe this is the part that you're saying didn't go as well?
Yeah, this would be what I was getting at with the, like many legal wins, they're nuanced and you don't win on everything. This was a really significant aspect of the decision. And I will say a significant aspect of the case for Gahatla as well. So as many will know, the BC government passed legislation, the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act in 2019, explicitly affirming that the UN Declaration applies to the laws of BC and that the BC government has a statutory duty to take all measures necessary to ensure that its laws are aligned with the UN Declaration. And this was, and the federal government, I should add, has passed substantially similar legislation in 2021. It's some of the wording is literally identical. And this was really the first case to test in a substantive way, what does that mean? So when we're talking about the duty to consult, what influence does that legislation have on the BC government's duty to carry out consultation in a manner that is upholding UNDRIP? And also, what does the statutory duty on BC to take all measures necessary to align its laws with UNDRIP mean when you have a nation, in this case, Gahatla, saying this particular law, the Mineral Tenure Act, and the decisions that you're making under it is misaligned with UNDRIP? And so two of the key, and I would say this is important for the mineral tenure aspects of it. It's also obviously has a broader importance because it relates to what legal interpretations and applications and changes UNDRIP and the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act are going to have on other issues going forward as well. And so how that was handled by the BC Supreme Court in its decision was, well, it said a few things. One of the things that it said was the affirmation in what I'll just call it DRIPA. It's the shorthand for Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act, DRIPA. The affirmation in DRIPA that the UN Declaration applies to the laws of BC is effectively a purpose statement that doesn't have substantive effects on the law. So it's meant to be, in this sort of the court's interpretation, it's meant to be about how the court looks at and interprets UNDRIP, but it doesn't actually give the UN Declaration any binding implications or any impose any obligations in terms of how to interpret and apply the UN Declaration in British Columbia. So that's one of the things it said. You know, it remains an entirely non-binding instrument, was I think almost the exact wording that the court used. And then the second thing it said was it was in relation to this connected question about what is the statutory obligation on BC to take all measures necessary to align its laws with the UN Declaration mean? Is it enforceable, or is it effectively a commitment to a political process that BC deals with through reporting to the legislature, through action plans, and all these other things that are set out in the legislation? And the court found that the DRIPA, the law, did not intend for the courts to wade in and determine if a law was inconsistent for the purposes of engaging the Crown's obligation to take all measures necessary to align a law. And that was what Gahatla was seeking. Gahatla was seeking a declaration from the court that said this specific regime, the mineral grant regime, is inconsistent with UNDRIP, so that BC's obligation under DRIPA to take all measures necessary is engaged. It was seeking a declaration to that effect, and the court basically said courts aren't going to make those declarations. That's not a matter to be addressed by the court. That's to be addressed through engagement between Indigenous peoples and the Crown. And the significant problem, certainly from Gahatla's perspective, that causes is there's no accountability to BC in any legal sense for that duty. And normally when you have a law, lawyers say laws are meant to be remedial. They're supposed to be a remedy. They're supposed to be something you can do that those rights actually mean something and can be enforced. And unfortunately, the result of the court's decision is that with respect to determining if a law is consistent with UNDRIP or not, you can't do that. You can't go to the court about it.
And I also noticed that a range of interveners, including other Indigenous nations, there was the BC Human Rights Commission and environmental groups like BCMLR, you know, that joined the case to support Gahatla. So what do you think, that this broad coalition of support, what does this signify for the case and the movement for mining reform in BC?
Yeah, it signifies two things, I would say. One, is it underlines that a turning point has been reached with regards to the mineral tenure regime specifically, where there's just such a critical mass of indigenous nations, human rights organizations, environmental organizations saying this system absolutely must change, that it is, I think, undeniable at this point that there needs to be significant repeal and replacement and overhaul of that system. And I think that that really showed up in the many interveners who made arguments indicating that they too had experienced the same kind of harms as a result of this, and made various legal arguments about why there was a duty that was being breached. So that's one significant aspect. The other comes back to what we were just talking about the UN Declaration and DRIPA, and that is the question, and in my view, the legal requirement of application of UNDRIP to the laws of BC and Canada is a rapidly evolving area of the law. These are recent pieces of legislation that were passed, and the BC Human Rights Commissioner, First Nations Leadership Council, they care very deeply about ensuring that the UN Declaration in all of its aspects is being upheld and applied, and that there's legal accountability in doing so. And so in addition to strong alignment on those mineral tenure issues, there was really a multitude of voices that were saying, this is a game-changing thing that we have legislation that is affirming the application of UNDRIP. And so I will sort of chase that by adding, we had this unfortunate decision from the BC Supreme Court in the sense of what it said about, the UN Declaration not having any sort of substantive impacts on the law. But that was immediately followed by two other decisions in different jurisdictions, that said different things. So just a month after Gahatla's decision, there was a decision called Montour from the Quebec Superior Court, which basically found the opposite, I would say, of what the court found in Gahatla's case. In that case, it was looking at the Federal Act, which, as I mentioned, is very similar in wording to BC's Act. And what the court found there is that the legislative affirmation of UNDRIP's application engages what's called a presumption of conformity with UNDRIP. So that means that courts should be preferring interpretations of the law, and statutory decision makers as well, who are making decisions under the law, should be preferring and applying interpretations of the law that are consistent and provide a level of protection at least as great as UNDRIP. And so that's almost the flip side of the coin of what happened in Gahatla's case, but it shows how sort of rapidly evolving this area of the law is. You've got two decisions within a month of each other that are, I would say, inconsistent with each other, and will need to be that sort of proceeds up to the higher courts. There will need to be a sort of ruling that finds a common statement of what these laws actually mean. And then just last week, the Supreme Court of Canada, Canada's highest court, it was in a reference about Indigenous Child and Family Services legislation, explicitly stated that as a result of the federal UN Declaration legislation, that UNDRIP has now been incorporated into the domestic positive law of the country, is the word that it used. So it used very strong language that UNDRIP is now part of the domestic law in Canada. Of course, it didn't have to address in that case what specifically does that mean, but sending a really strong signal, I think, that this is not just nice political words. This has a legal impact. And so I think we will continue to see, including through the appeals in Gahatla's case, and I think in other cases, this issue of ensuring that it means something, that we've affirmed legislatively that the UN Declaration applies, ensuring that it has a legal meaning, excuse me.
And actually, so to follow up on that, do you know of any other similar challenges that are on the horizon or are ongoing at the moment that could further shape this issue?
Yeah, so there are no. I mean, those two cases that I just mentioned are both very significant in that regard. The Montour decision out of Quebec that I mentioned first, I believe, is under appeal. So there that will also be addressed by the Quebec Court of Appeal, and of course the The reference from the Supreme Court of Canada, it won't be appealed because they're the highest court, but it sets in place a lot of important frameworks and statements that are going to be fleshed out in other decisions. So what does it actually mean on the ground?
And so getting back to the Kakatla case, so the court gave BC 18 months to design a new mineral staking regime that incorporates Indigenous consultation. Are you able to sort of anticipate what this might mean for mining in BC?
Yeah, I mean, so it's a yes and no. So the, I mean, I guess the no part is because the regime will be, it has to be under the Declaration Act, co-designed with Indigenous peoples. The actual shape of what it'll practically look like on the ground is to be determined. However, the principles or requirements that it needs to be meeting, I think, are pretty clear. And so some of the examples are, I mean, first off, the practice of granting rights to minerals automatically is gone. Like there's no way that continues to exist. But if we're talking about a regime that is aligned with the UN Declaration, what that actually means is shifting to recognition of Indigenous nations as decision makers in relation to these issues. And so creating structures whereby, there's a pre-decision system where, you know, mining interests can get priority among themselves, but they don't actually get any rights to minerals. They don't get rights on the ground to do exploration without the free, prior, and informed consent of Indigenous nations. And I think ideally what that looks like is setting, rather than a sort of case-by-case-by-case basis, is setting up structures that encourage and implement land-based decision-making. So for example, you know, go zones and no-go zones, or, you know, red, yellow, green light areas, whatever nations want that to look like, to be making some decisions in advance about here's where you definitely can't go. And then here's where you can go if you meet these types of conditions, and have that that certainty up front. And so I actually believe that UNDRIP-aligned reform is not only an opportunity to ensure respect for inherent Indigenous rights to decision-making, I think it just will result in better decision-making generally, because the problem for many mineral exploration companies now is, you know, they get these mineral claims, which grant them rights typically without knowledge of the nation concerned, and they've immediately established, they've got off on the wrong foot. And even for nations that may be considering mining, they certainly aren't going to be welcoming their rights to those minerals being granted to third parties without their knowledge. And they're, without those types of agreements and alignment, it's going to be very difficult for mineral exploration interests to actually proceed. And so I think, you know, recognizing the reality that we're in this UN declaration era now, and that includes respect for Indigenous decision making, means a shift in business models for mineral exploration interests to be approaching Indigenous nations up front, and for those that are interested, you know, pursuing partnerships or whatever structure nations and those exploration interests want to pursue, but also recognizing that some nations are going to say no, or they're going to say no in some places, and that's going to have to be respected. And so I actually think in the long term, it'll be of a benefit to not only to nations, but also to mineral exploration interests that aren't going to be acquiring interests that they effectively can't actually develop because nations are going to take them to court, or there's going to be blockades on the land, or whatever it is that, you know, nations are going to do to uphold their own legal regime in that regard.
So in wrapping up this interview, I'm wondering if I can ask you a personal question. You mentioned that you've been with the West Coast Environmental Law for more than a decade, and, you know, you've worked on this case. I'm sure you've worked on other cases where you've supported Indigenous nations to, you know, assert their rights. I'd want to ask you to sort of reflect on what that journey has been like, and also what lessons do you think can be drawn from your experience for other environmental lawyers and as well as activists?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, there's a few questions in there, I guess. One observation I would make, having been sort of working on these issues for probably about 15 years, is there is a sea change happening, I think, with regard to both legal and broader societal recognition of the impacts of colonialism on Indigenous peoples, but also the inherent laws and legal orders of Indigenous nations, their right and ability and longstanding practice to make their own decisions according to their own unique cultural and legal frameworks. And, you know, when I went to law school, we, in one of my first year classes, you know, we got a draft of this book called Canada's Indigenous Constitution by John Burroughs, an Indigenous legal scholar who some will be familiar with. And, you know, in an academic context, these discussions around Indigenous laws being real and treating them as laws were sort of cutting edge in a law school to be talking about those kind of things. And I would say that is, in the last, you know, 15 years or so, it's now become very common for, and I think accepted among many, that Indigenous laws are law. They are real. Indigenous nations have been operating according to them for centuries, and they've been deeply impacted by colonialism, but they continue to exist, and they are evolving to meet the new challenges of the era that we live in. And I think that broader societal recognition of that fact that Indigenous peoples have always known is really significant. And I'm hopeful that it will open up more political and legal space for new ways of doing things and new ways of making decisions that actually recognize those rights on the ground. And I would say that is where we continue to, and I'm sure will continue to see challenges, is the rhetoric is there now, I think, you know, the rhetoric of recognition of Indigenous law, but there are many entrenched interests that would be very happy to say that those words and not actually have to change anything. And so now it's about translating that rhetoric into action.
All right. I mean, you didn't capture the second part of my question. I don't know if you want to.
Yeah. So the second part of your question being sort of thoughts for, you know, activists and lawyers working in this field.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I can only offer my own personal reflections, which have been treating, I guess, starting from the beginner's mind always, as a, you know, as a white guy coming to work and, you know, trained in Canadian laws and Crown legal orders, coming to support Indigenous nations has been a continuing process of recognizing what I don't know and being willing to try to be a continuing learner. And so, you know, not assuming that I have the answers. And I think what has been really, let's say, beautiful and empowering for me about that is in getting to work so closely with Indigenous nations that are, they're doing this governance revitalization work on the ground, is, you know, seeing that other world that is possible of communities that that are facing very significant challenges, but are drawing on, you know, their ancient teachings, they're applying it in modern contexts. And it's sort of a, for an outsider such as myself, it's like a seeing is believing kind of moment to, it's very difficult to explain, but to be there, you can experience a way of governing, a way of relationships that is truly different. And from my experience, you know, very inspiring and powerful in comparison to the understandings that I was brought up with about how governments work and what governance is, and really bringing in a connection to the land and to communities and to relationships. And so I guess that would be a roundabout way of saying, I think in addition to, you know, being committed to doing the legal and policy and activist, quote unquote, aspects of the work, it is as important or perhaps more important to do the work of understanding and trying to connect with and learning about my own relationship to the land, the territory that I'm on, the relationships that I have. How am I showing up in my entire personal life as well in a way that is reflecting the ideals and the systems and structures that I want to see sort of flourish and take root around me. And so, I think really emphasizing the personal aspect of that and the inquisitive nature and the sort of the commitment to lifelong learning that is required to be able to do the work well, while recognizing that, you know, we're all learning as we go along as well.
Well, thanks so much, Gavin. This was great.
That was great to talk. Thanks.
Thanks to Gavin for the enlightening conversation. It's clear that the path toward mineral tenure reform and reconciliation in BC is fraught with difficulties, yet filled with potential for positive change. For more information on BC mining law reform and how you can get involved, please visit our website, reformbcmining.ca. Thank you for tuning in. We look forward to having you with us in the next episode, which will feature a discussion with journalist Christopher Pollan on his recent book, Pitfall: The Race to Mine the World's Most Vulnerable Places. See you then.